My name is Paul Taylor, and it's a privilege this morning to continue our series in Haggai. Today, we're going to talk about tomorrow. If you're here 2 weeks ago, you're probably saying, oh no, not this today, tomorrow, yesterday thing again, so I'll spare you that. But today, we're going to be talking about what it means to look forward, what it means to have hope. We've touched on this several times in the last several weeks, but now we're really going to dive into what hope looks like for us. I've been trying to use some cultural media as we go through this as a way of kind of giving us an idea of how our culture addresses some of the issues that Haggai's brought up. We've seen some movies and song clips. I'm going to do a similar thing today, but as a form of cultural media, I'm going to use a painting. So it's a type of media, but it's a little bit of an older media. So to get us kind of introduced in the way of thinking about hope, I'm going to give us a bit of an art history lesson. Caspar David Friedrich painted during the turn of the 18th century, late 1700s, early 1800s. He was part of an art movement called German Romanticism. And the German Romantics liked to paint landscapes, primarily because they had a view of God, that God was everywhere. God was one with nature. God was one with us. Their view is described as pantheism, the idea that God is everywhere. You may realize right away two things. First, that is not what Christians believe. We believe in a God that is other. We believe in a God that created the universe rather than a God that is the universe. Secondly, you may realize that that's a view of God that actually is pretty prevalent today. Some people speak of that explicitly. Others you can kind of pick up in the way they think about the world, the way they think about nature. They view everything together as comprising God. So Friedrich was a part of that movement, but he had different theological convictions. He believed in the God that's revealed in Scripture. He believed in the God that we believe in. And he believed his art was a form of worship to that God. He painted landscapes, but he did so not because of what he saw, but because of what he thought the Bible revealed. His paintings were, in effect, painted interpretations of biblical ideas. Painted interpretations of biblical ideas conveyed primarily through landscapes. So with that background, I want us to look at one of his most famous paintings. It's called The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, and it should be shown behind you. This painting has everything to do with tomorrow. To fully understand it, though, we need to understand a little bit about how Friedrich thought about his paintings and how he used symbols. Whenever he painted people, he tended to paint them with their backs toward you. And he did so as if to invite you to participate in a private moment that you're witnessing. So when you see his paintings, you're not so much an observer, but you're a participant. And what you're invited to participate in is a particular view of looking toward the future. He usually used fog to represent divine mystery. And rocks in his painting always referred to the solidity of the Christian faith, of what Christians knew to be true. You may notice too, as you look at this painting, that the man seems kind of dwarfed by the vastness of the landscape in front of him, but that as you move forward, the fog in the landscape kind of disappears into nothing. Friedrich is inviting us to look into the future. In contrast to the pantheism that surrounded him, he is saying that there is a God who looks forward. If God is one with nature, then the only hope we have is what nature offers us. But if God is above nature, if God created nature, then God can intervene in nature and offer us hope. So as we look forward, we look past the mystery, and as the landscape fades away, we're reminded that there is something else, that there is a next life. There is something for Christians to look forward to. And so we're given hope. And that's what we're going to be focusing on this morning. We spent the last 4 weeks looking through Haggai. Once again, this is a book of four messages given from God through Haggai to a remnant of Jews living in Jerusalem trying to rebuild the temple, the physical, visible manifestation of God's presence in their midst. So all of Haggai, this whole book, is an encouragement to persevere in making God real. And as we come to the last message, we're going to see God leaving his people with a message of hope, a reminder about how to make God real as we look forward to tomorrow. So let's look at Haggai chapter 2, verses 20 to 23 as we wrap up this book and find out what kind of hope God gives his people and what kind of hope God gives us. We'll start by reading the first three verses, 20 through 22. This is Haggai 2, 20 through 22. The word of the Lord came to Haggai a second time on the 24th day of the month. Tell Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, that I will shake the heavens and the earth. I will overturn royal thrones and shatter the power of foreign kingdoms. I will overthrow chariots and their drivers. Horses and their riders will fall, each by the sword of his brother. The message that God begins with is a simple one. God wins. When it's all said and done, God wins. But he doesn't just say that he wins. He does so in a way that wraps around the whole biblical story. He says that he will shake the heavens and the earth. This phrase is used throughout Scripture to refer to the whole of God's creation. We find it on the first page of our Bibles in Genesis 1:1, where we read, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." It comes up again at the end of our Bibles in Revelation 21, verse 1, when John says, "I saw a new heaven and a new earth." And so God began by creating the heavens and the earth. He will end by recreating the heavens and the earth. And in the middle, his people live amidst a creation that isn't always friendly to them. But God gives the reminder that he is at work, that he will shake that creation. He will bring it to completion. He will restore creation to be what he originally intended. And so God wins over nature. God wins over nature. But he also reminds them that he wins in another way. God wins over nations. Verse 22 tells us that he will shatter the power of foreign kingdoms. Horses and riders will fall. The language here brings us back to the story of the Exodus when the Jews left Egypt. Immediately after that victory, Moses sang a song about the horses and the riders being thrown into the sea. And the language here reminds us of that event and brings us back to recall that God wins over foreign nations. God wins over nations. So God wins. And the issue of winning, I think, is a pretty big deal to us. We talk about being good sports, and it doesn't matter who wins, it's how you play the game. But I think we really care about who wins. Let me explain what I mean. In eighth grade, I wrestled in our all-school wrestling tournament. The whole school was invited. We took the day off from school. Everybody came to this tournament. In eighth grade, I was a pretty scrawny, nerdy, kind of weak little kid. I know that's hard to believe now, looking at me, but you'll just have to take my word for it. And my opponent in this tournament was Todd Champagne. Todd Champagne. He was the strongest, the best looking, the most popular kid in the school. He was dating the most beautiful girl in eighth grade, and he was to be my opponent in this wrestling tournament. So the day of the tournament came. We go out on the mat. We shake hands. The ref blows the whistle. We start to wrestle. 10 seconds later, the match is over. And do you know who won? Todd Champagne. He pinned me in under 10 seconds. It's a pretty depressing story, right? I mean, come on. You all wanted the scrawny, nerdy Paul to rise up over Todd Champagne, but it didn't happen. Because we care about who wins. We want to know who wins. And because of that, God reminds us that he wins. He wins over nature. He wins over nations. And if you think about these Jews living in Jerusalem, you might realize that these two threats are really the two primary threats they had to deal with. They were an agrarian culture, and they didn't have sophisticated means of protecting themselves from natural circumstances. They faced droughts, floods, storms, disease. So they needed to know that God wins over nature. But they also lived amidst a Persian-occupied Jerusalem. They faced foreign enemies all the time. They were always in danger of being double-crossed or overthrown or sold into slavery. So they needed to know that God wins over nations. Two major threats that they faced, nature, nations, two ways that God wins. Nature, nations. So in the first part of this passage, we learn then that God wins, and it's a message of hope. But the passage goes on to say more. Not only does God win, but he chooses the winning team. And the message to Zerubbabel, living in Jerusalem, was that he was God's captain. God chooses him for his victory. Let's read verse 23. On that day, declares the Lord Almighty, I will take you, my servant Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and I will make you like my signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord Almighty. So God has chosen Zerubbabel to receive hope in the midst of these circumstances. But to really get a picture of what's going on here, we need to go back and find out a little more about who this guy Zerubbabel was. To do that, we're going to take a brief look kind of at his family photo album. I'm going to show you some photos, paint some pictures in your minds to get us to look into that. I have an uncle in my family who's kind of known as the family historian. He takes pictures at every event, and it's an important role. Have you ever looked back at a photo album of your parents or grandparents, and you kind of realize why things are today the way they are? That crooked smile that your sister has, that's from your grandmother. Or the way your brother holds himself, that's because your grandfather stood that way. And all of a sudden, things in the present make sense because you understand the past. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to look back through Zerubbabel's photo album to find out why what God tells him here is so significant. The first picture I want to show you is from way back, 500 years before where we're talking about now. We're at about 1000 BC. And this is a picture of a young man. His hair is glistening with oil. It's David. He's just been crowned king over Israel. And David was the golden boy for Israel. He was the king that they always loved. He ruled over the best period of the nation. And God promised him that his line, his descendants, would always be king over Israel. The next picture, we're going to jump forward about 100 years. Now we're at about 900 BC. And it's a picture of David's grandson. His name is Rehoboam. And he's an arrogant young man. And we see him standing in the picture with people running away from him, flooding out of Jerusalem. See, Rehoboam made a terrible mistake, and the nation split under his leadership. 10 of the 12 tribes left, rejecting his kingship. 2 tribes stayed, faithful to the Davidic line of kings in Jerusalem. And this is a sad picture. God's people broken. It's the type of thing you don't talk about at family reunions all that much. Our next picture jumps forward another 300 years. Now we're at 600 BC. A long descendant of Rehoboam, this man's name is Jehoiachin. And it's another sad picture because we see Jehoiachin, a king in the line of David, on his knees. And standing above him is a mean-looking man by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. See, Jehoiachin was a king of Israel, the king of Judah, but he surrendered Jerusalem to Babylon. He gave up the throne. This picture has a caption underneath it. You can find that caption in Jeremiah 22, verse 24, where God says, as surely as I live, even if you, Jehoiachin, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, I would still pull you off. Seeing a king in the line of David surrendering to Babylon, it's a sad picture. It makes you think all hope might be lost. And this signet ring imagery is going to be very important. I actually wear a signet ring on my right hand. It's got the initials on it of my grandfather, who was a Lutheran pastor. And it's special to me because I never met my grandfather. He died before I was born, but it was his dream that one of his grandchildren become a pastor. I'm the youngest of 22 or 3 or 4, and I'm the only one that's become a pastor. So I feel connected to him in some way because I wear his ring. In some way I represent him. In some way he's a part of my ministry, even though he's passed on. So for God to compare Jehoiachin to a signet ring that's been cast off is to say that he's been rejected. That the role of the Davidic kings to represent God to the world is no longer in play. That's not happening. Well, the next picture we have goes forward a little more, and it's a picture of young Zerubbabel, a cute little baby boy, bouncing on his father Shealtiel's lap. In the distance behind him, you can see Jehoiachin, now an old man, and the scenery behind him is Persia, the land of exile, where Zerubbabel would have grown up. And our last picture in the photo album is a recent picture of Zerubbabel. And now he looks tired. He's standing amidst the ruins of Jerusalem. To his right, you might see some grain, practically decimated from the drought. To his left, you might see the Samaritans mocking him for his silly task of working on the temple. Behind him, you might see some angry Persians keeping close watch. In front of him are some tired and dirty Jews, discouraged and exhausted from the work of building the temple. This is the man that Haggai 2:20-23 is written to. You may have noticed that the other messages in this series were written to many people, to Zerubbabel, to Joshua, and to the remnant. But this message, the last message, is written only to Zerubbabel. And he is told that God wins. He is given hope specifically tailored to the circumstances that he is facing. In the midst of a drought, he's told that God wins over nature. In the midst of roughing it in Persian-occupied Jerusalem, he is told that God wins over nations. Having grown up as a Davidic king in exile, wondering if God's promise for David's line would come true, he is told that he is the signet ring, back on God's right hand, that what was lost has been restored. So he is given hope exactly where he needs it. He is given hope where it hurts. God offers him hope, and he receives it. Well, as part of God's people, he offers us the same hope. Just as Zerubbabel received hope right where it hurts, we receive hope where it hurts. He offers us hope in the face of living life in a dangerous creation, uncertain of what disaster, disorder, or disease tomorrow might bring. He offers us hope in the midst of living amidst uncertain relationships, where we interact daily with people who hate us and people who hurt us. He offers us hope where it hurts. But what is that hope? Is it that things will get better, that our lives will gradually improve? Well, Zerubbabel never did overcome the Persians like he might have hoped. He never quite had freedom from droughts and natural disasters. So does that mean that God's promise to him failed? Some people would say so. Because of the way history played out, one scholar said this of our passage: Haggai's promises are an idle dream that never took shape in history. Another concludes that Haggai was mistaken in his expectations for the immediate future. So God's promise didn't come true for Zerubbabel in the short term. But I think what God was doing was pointing him further, pointing him beyond the short term to where God ultimately wins. And I think that's where he's pointing us, to the end of the story, to the place where the landscape and the fog clears away, to our ultimate hope, to the end of the story. So what does it mean for you to receive hope where it hurts? Where does it hurt for you? How does God offer hope? Right there. I don't know the details of what's going on in each of our lives, but I know that we need to hear this message of hope. Maybe you're lonely and you desperately want to be connected with people. Or maybe you're tired. You feel like you've been living the same thing day in and day out, and life just seems to have lost its meaning. Or maybe you're facing a new season and you're uncertain of what lies ahead and you're scared. You don't know what it could be. In the midst of those circumstances, God offers us hope. right there alongside Zerubbabel, he speaks into our specific circumstances and tells us that he wins. Things may not change completely in this life, but we are drawn forward to our ultimate hope, where we know that God will win, to the end of the story. We receive hope where it hurts. But Zerubbabel wasn't just the recipient of hope. As we read forward in the biblical story, we find out that he was also the instrument of hope. God used him to give hope to the world. We read about this when we get to the New Testament. Right there in the Gospels, in both accounts of the lineage of Jesus, we have Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, taking place in Jesus' coming to earth. And then we remember that the Davidic line did continue. And it didn't reach its climax in Zerubbabel. It reached its climax in Jesus Christ, a Davidic king come on earth to bring in the new kingdom. And Zerubbabel wasn't the ultimate signet ring. Jesus was. He came as the representative of God. He came to bring God's rule to earth. And we share in that same calling that Zerubbabel had. Remember our images of how God has made himself real? The pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke that God used to make himself real to the people of Israel leaving Egypt. The cross reminding us of the person of Jesus making God real to the world. And the dove that reminds us of us as the spirit indwelt people of God making God real. And we're reminded of the new heavens and the new earth, and that our story moves forward to something worth waiting for. We are the signet ring. We are called to offer hope to the world. We are called to receive hope where it hurts, but we're also called to offer hope where it hurts. I think that one of the issues that plagues us as a culture is our lack of hope. Our lack of hope. In some ways, things are getting better and better and better. Our cars are faster and cleaner. Our computers are smaller and more powerful. Our homes are more comfortable. Our food is fresher and healthier. Our phones get smaller and they do more things. Apple sold 700,000 iPhones the first weekend it was available. I mean, in some ways, things are getting better. But in other ways, and maybe in the ways that matter, things are getting worse. We're depressed. We're lonely. We're uncertain of the future. We long to belong to a stable group of people. We have so much stuff, and yet we still feel empty inside. We look forward to getting into the best school. We want to find the best job. We try to find the best spouse. And once we do, we quickly become convinced that there's a better school out there, or a better job, or a better spouse. We want to look forward to things, to new things, but when we get there, we realize that we're still empty. We're starved for hope. And so we cling to insignificant replicas of what we really long for. One of the things that I think makes it difficult for us in our culture to have hope, and makes it difficult for us as a church to offer hope to our world, is that things are pretty good for us. Our lives are pretty okay. We've managed to make our lives pretty enjoyable. We've managed to remove a lot of the things that cause us discomfort and pain. And we've convinced ourselves that we're so close, we're only a step away from really getting there. Maybe the next gadget will get us there. Maybe the next diet, or maybe the next sermon series will get us to where we really long to be. And this can be especially true in this area. I have a friend of mine who used to live in this area who says that living in Northern California makes it really hard to believe in heaven. And that can be the case for us as we live lives that are just actually pretty good. If life is so good here, what do I need hope for? What do I need a really real God for? This came clear to me this past week. Saturday, a week ago, we went to the farmer's market as a family in Sunnyvale. And this is my favorite time of year for the farmer's market. I mean, I like apples and oranges, don't get me wrong, but now is when you get the good stuff. Peaches, nectarines, plums, corn. So we're at the farmer's market, and it's just a wonderful time walking around in beautiful 76-degree weather, and I practically thought I was in heaven. Did you catch that? I felt like I was in heaven. And I did feel that way, but I wasn't in heaven. And that was made clear to me pretty quickly. We sat down at a bench at the end of the farmer's market, and we're having this delicious lunch. As we're sitting there, an older woman tried to step up over the curb, and her foot caught on the curb, and she fell to the ground, and her head hit the concrete with this sickening noise. For a second, we just kind of sat there, and then we all reacted. We got up, and we helped her up, and she had this huge gash on her forehead. She's bleeding everywhere. We called 911. The police came, the paramedics came, and they started to treat her. It came out that she's 74 years old, and they asked her, do you have anybody we can call to meet you at the hospital? She said, no, I'll be okay. I'll be fine. And my picture of paradise was just crushed. It was so sad to think of this woman. All she wanted to do was sit down. She had a baked potato in her hand and eat this baked potato at the farmer's market, but her morning ended very differently. And as I walked out of the farmer's market, past the peaches and the plums, I found that I was nauseated by them. They no longer appealed to me. I was sick in my stomach because I was reminded that this isn't heaven. And it was a stark reminder. So even when our lives are comfortable and good, there are times when we remember that there is something more. We need hope. And the funny thing is, those times often come through pain. I want to suggest that pain opens us up to the experience of hope. Pain opens us up to the offer of hope. It opens us up to the reality that we long for a better place, that things here aren't what we want them to be, that we need hope. And then God steps in, and he offers hope right where it hurts. And I want to suggest that for us as a church, this is how we can interact with our world. We can look at where the pain is, and we can know that those are the places that people are ready, are longing, are aware of their need for hope. Because where they're hurting, they're reminded of their need. This is why ministries like Recovery are so helpful, because they meet people where they're at. They offer hope right where it hurts. So we look at our world and we ask, where are the hurts? And what would it mean for us to offer hope in the midst of those hurts? This kind of hope often initially works to provide relief for whatever it is people are struggling with. If they're addicted to drugs or alcohol or sex or pornography, we help them to break that addiction. If they're struggling with making ends meet day to day, then we help them to make their lives more financially viable. If they're lonely or depressed, we come alongside of them as comforters and companions. But we do all of this in a way that points them forward, past the immediate hope that we're giving them, towards the larger hope. We don't just fix their problems, we call them forward to the hope that God ultimately offers them. The hope we offer in the midst of their circumstances points them forward to the end of the story. What would it look like to ask those questions? Where are people hurting? How can I offer hope in the midst of that? What would it look like to ask that as individuals or as a family? What would it look like to ask that as a church, to rally behind that? And there are several ways that we are doing this as a church. Several of our ministries have this type of mentality. I want to highlight one that's growing and might have more opportunities in the future. For several months now, several men, Jay Heeb, Bill Dwyer, Steve Holman, and others, have been gathering together on Saturday mornings to provide relief to people in very practical ways. Painting houses, repairing fences, clearing brush. They're offering people hope where it hurts, in a way that draws them forward and points out the larger hope. If you're interested in this type of opportunity, stay tuned. There's talk of expanding this and doing bigger scale in the future. Because these are the kinds of questions that we need to be asking as a church. Where are the hurts, and how can we get in there to offer hope amidst them? Well, as we conclude this message, we stand alongside Zerubbabel as recipients of hope and instruments of hope. We're reminded that God wins, and because of our confidence that God will overcome, we take hope ourselves and we offer hope to the world. Which brings us back to our painting, The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog. Looking toward the next life with hope, standing firm on the rock of the Christian faith, anticipating the next life when God will win. Can we believe in that hope for ourselves? And can we offer that to a world that desperately needs it? And with the end of this message, we've come to the end of our series on Haggai. It's a short little book, but it's offered at a significant point in the history of the nation of Israel. And it addresses issues that are very real for us today. He reminds us that we serve a really real God. And he encourages us to get to work on making that God seem real to ourselves and to the world. As we've been reading through Haggai, we've been looking at the various things that make God seem unreal to us. The first week we talked about distractions, so that where the things of this world can seem more real than the things of God's world. The second week we talked about how nostalgia for the past can paralyze us in the present and make us forget God's reality. The third week we saw how disappointment can lead to demanding God treat us a certain way. And today we've seen how discouragement can make us forget that God looks forward, that there is something awaiting us. These are the things that lure us away from engaging in relationship with God: distractions, nostalgia, disappointment, discouragement. And in the midst of these, what does God offer? Himself. He offers his presence, a relationship with him. The presence of God reminds us of his reality amidst distractions. The presence of God focuses on today in the midst of nostalgia for the past. The presence of God in our lives makes sense of disappointment. And the presence of God gives us hope for what comes in the future. And so Haggai reminds us of the presence of a really real God. The cruel irony for the Israelites is what they needed most. What they needed was the temple of God, the presence of their God among them. The one thing they needed is the one thing they lost motivation for. And that can be true of us as well. We tend to forget God when we need him the most. So what does the presence of God look like for us? We asked that question the first week, and several of you filled out cards in response to that. We collected about 150 cards. We've compiled them into a book that shows how God has made himself real to us. A glimpse of the Holy Spirit at work in our lives here at Peninsula Bible Church. Your responses to how God is real in this body. These books are waiting for you at the table out back as you leave. I encourage you to pick one of these up and read through it. It's incredibly encouraging to see the reality of God for us, for this group of people. And as we do so, we can remember that it's our responsibility to make God real for others and ask the question, how do we do that? And may Haggai's reminder motivate us and encourage us to get to work. Thank you.